Good evening. Welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Sarah Holliday, Library Events Coordinator. As we begin, may I ask you please to turn off cell phones or any device that might disrupt the event. Appreciate it. As you know, the library offers some beautiful writing spaces and a range of programming oriented toward writers. We're delighted to have with us this evening two authors that we see often in the building and who've participated in our writers' events as both presenters and audience members. Caitlin Macy, author of The Fundamentals of Play and other works, will give you a few words about our main speaker, Gretchen Rubin. Ms. Macy.
Hello, is that all right? Okay, thanks, Sarah. When I moved to the city about 20 years ago, I was overwhelmed by the choices I suddenly had, by the new optionality of my life post-university. They say you have a lot of freedom in college. Well, try showing up in a world where you suddenly have no more homework. Should I stay in or go out, I used to wonder. Should I take the subway or the bus? Should I live on the Upper East Side or the Lower East Side? Thank goodness back then no one had heard of Brooklyn. Meanwhile, every time I passed a deli, my steps would falter and I'd hesitate, unable to move on until I answered that ultimate existential question, should I buy a black and white cookie? At around the same time, I discovered yoga. I'd enjoy the workout part of the class, but at the end, when we had to lie in Shavasana, corpse pose as it's called, I'd wait for the golden light the teacher would mention to bloom inside of me or descend from on high or surround me in whatever way it was supposed to surround me. In any case, I'd become increasingly twitchy and irritated at my inability to be in the moment because of the long laundry list of things I felt the moment was preventing me from getting done, first and foremost of those usually being the laundry itself. I guess that's where I honed my notion that happiness was something that would strike one out of the blue. At least it would strike one if one were lucky. And that, along the lines of, if you have to ask, you'll never know, to try to be happy implied one never would be. Now, I'd never buy a book on weight loss if I couldn't immediately flip to that middle section where they lay out the actual diet. But so much of self-help, or call it happiness literature, can seem vague. Lots of abstract self-improvement, where they never, probably in a bid to reach a wider audience, I'm guessing, really give you the goods. What Gretchen Rubin had both the insight to realize and the audacity to own and to share is that happiness is a most idiosyncratic goal. It's founded not on vague hopes, or in my case, of awaiting while twitching and frowning that elusive golden light, but on specifics, even, if I can say it, neuroses. To take an example from Gretchen's first book, The Happiness Project, if we're the kind of person who feels happier making our bed in the morning, the answer is not to spend a lot of energy trying to get into a Zen state wherein we no longer care about having an unmade bed. The elegant answer simply is to make it. For years, sweating the small stuff was shorthand for the uptight, neurotic behavior that we were all supposed to be vaguely ashamed of. It turns out it's okay to give in to those impulses after all. It's okay to make your bed every morning, as long as it makes you happy. I can't tell you what a relief it was to be told this. My husband was thrilled too. Gretchen has now turned to a topic that can only resonate more loudly for New Yorkers than, I would venture to say, any other group in her readership, however vast it is, happiness in the home. Who hasn't experienced the joy of cleaning out one's closet or organizing one's files? In New York, I believe that we experience that joy exponentially given our space limitations. We have all chosen to live in this crowded, dirty, exhausting, expensive city where no matter what the size of our living space, we know we could triple it if we went elsewhere. So apparently, happiness must not be solely about square footage. I'm going to turn things over now to the author of Happier at Home, who I know will enlighten us further, Gretchen Rubin.
Well, I'm very happy to be speaking to you here tonight, and it is so appropriate that I'm here at Society Library talking about happiness because few things in my life make me as happy as the New York Society Library. I have written enormous chunks of all my books here. I check out books all the time. My family checks out books all the time. It's beautiful. It's perfect in every way. And so I'm just thrilled to be here and to be talking about happiness. So I'm going to start by talking for a few minutes about how I got the idea to write Happier at Home. And then I'm going to throw out some very manageable, realistic resolutions that you might think about trying if you're interested in trying to be happier at home. And do not worry, these are all things that don't take a lot of time, energy, or money, because nobody has much extra time, energy, or money. And then we'll have time for questions, which is always my favorite part. I love to hear what other people are thinking about happiness. I got the idea to write Happier at Home in a very inconspicuous moment of my life. I was standing in my own kitchen, which is exactly one block away from right here, unloading the dishwasher. I could hear my husband in the next room watching a golf game, and my daughters were playing restaurant, when I was hit by an intense wave of homesickness. I felt the way that I felt when I went to summer camp for the first time. And this was a very puzzling feeling, because why was I feeling homesick if I was standing right in the middle of my own kitchen? I realized it was as if I had been rocketed forward 30 years and was in the future thinking back with yearning with what I have right here and right now. The puzzling intensity of this feeling really got me to focus for the first time on the idea of home. Because I'd been reading and writing and researching about happiness for years, but I had never looked at it from this idea of home, which really is one of the most universal aspects of happiness. And really, so many of the elements of a happy life come together in the idea of home. Things like body, neighborhood, possessions, parenthood, family, they all have their role to play. So I thought, I'm going to do another happiness project, but this time I'm going to go narrower and deeper and really see what I can do to be happier at home. But before you do any kind of happiness project, there are a few threshold questions that you have to answer. And I'm sure you've thought about these yourself if you've thought about happiness. The first is, okay, what is happiness anyway? I started my career as a lawyer, so I have happy memories of spending an entire semester debating the definition of contract. If anything, happiness is an even more elusive concept to define. There are something like 15 academic definitions of happiness. But I decided that for the lay person, the looseness of happiness, of the term happiness, was an advantage, because it could be contentment or satisfaction or peace or bliss or joy, and it was big enough to encompass all of these ideas. And that for most people, having an exact definition wasn't really that important. And I usually think about it in terms of being happier. This week, next month, next year, if I do a certain resolution, is it going to make me happier? Because happiness can sound like sort of a magical destination. How do you get there? What does it look like? How do you stay there? And happier is just about progress. The next question is, okay, can you make yourself happier? Some people argue that everyone has a set point. And you might go up or you might go down, but you're always going to go back to that set point. I think it's more helpful to think about a set range. It does seem that about 50% of happiness is genetically determined. Some people are born Tiggers. Some people are born Eeyores. And that's pretty much hardwired. Then about 10 to 20% is life circumstances, which is things like age, health, income, education, marital status. Then all the rest is very much influenced by the way that we think and the way that we act. And that's where you can really consciously influence your happiness. To push yourself up to the top part of your range, or to press yourself down to the bottom part of your range. Then the third threshold question about happiness is a much more profound question. And that's whether it's selfish to want to be happier. Happiness has a surprisingly bad reputation. And many people assume that happy people are superficial or stupid. In fact, studies show, and I think common experience confirms this, that happy people are more interested in the problems of other people and more interested in the problems of the world. They're more altruistic, they give away more money, they volunteer more time, they're more likely to help out when a colleague or a family member or a friend needs help. They make better team members and better leaders. They're healthier and have healthier habits. When we're unhappy, we tend to become defensive, isolated, and preoccupied with our own problems. And when we're happy, we have the emotional wherewithal to turn outward and to think about other people and the problems of the world. So if it is selfish to want to be happier, we should be selfish, if only for selfless reasons. So once you think, yes, I want to be happier, but where do I start? What do I do? It can be hard to know where to start because happiness can feel very abstract, very transcendent. So what do you do tomorrow morning? I think a great place to start is with your own body, because your physical experience always colors your emotional experience. And the first resolution that I'm going to propose is so basic that you will laugh and think that it is silly to mention it, but it has to be said. To be happy, you have to get enough sleep. How many people here regularly get 7 hours of sleep a night or more? Not that many. How many people here regularly use the snooze alarm? Okay, that's an instrument of torture. So it turns out that a lack of sleep affects your mood, your memory, your immune function. They even think it contributes to weight gain. You will run into people who will say, I've trained myself to get by on 5 hours of sleep. I don't need any more. But when scientists study these people, they are quite impaired. A lack of sleep really will show up in your energy level and your mood. It's very important to just turn out the light. By the same token, it's very important to resolve to get some exercise. You do not need to train for the marathon or go to an hour spin class. Even something like a 15 or 20-minute walk outside will make a huge difference. Now, this is where we're lucky as New Yorkers, because it's really impossible for New Yorkers to be truly sedentary the way people in other parts of the country seem to be. I was just reading an article saying that for some people are so out of shape that something like cooking dinner is a workout for them. And you know, you just have to walk 15 or 20 minutes as a New Yorker. So pat yourself on the back, realize that you're getting this very important health boost, and go out of your way to try to get a little bit more exercise. Also, if you're a person who has trouble sleeping, exercise helps you fall asleep faster and sleep more deeply. And if you feel tired, for most people, exercise boosts energy instead of depleting energy. So feeling tired is a reason to exercise, not a reason to skip exercising. But here is a secret tip. Let's say it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon and you're dragging and you don't have time to take a nap and you can't go for a walk outside and you just need a fix of energy and good cheer. What can you do right now? Just jump up and down a few times. Do jumping jacks by your desk, run down the stairs, jump over a puddle. There is something about getting both feet off the ground. It is childlike, it's playful, it's kind of goofy, especially if other people can see you, and it will really change your mood. And the third resolution I would suggest you think about related to your body is one of my newer resolutions and one of my very favorite resolutions. And that is the resolution to embrace good smells. And the sense of smell is interesting because it's part of our experience that if we pay attention to it, it becomes much more salient. But if we don't pay attention to it, it just sort of fades away and we're not consciously tuned into it. So it's something that you can really control by just paying attention to it. And to remind you of the pleasures of good scents, I've passed out my little smells. So if you have your bag of little smells, you can smell them and start passing them around. And to tell you about these two smells, they are created by an unconventional perfumer named Christopher Brosius, who has a gallery in Williamsburg. And he does a lot of perfumes that aren't perfumes like you would wear, or they're not really room scents. They're just really interesting smells. And the two smells you have there, one is called At the Beach 1966. And it is the smell of being at the beach. And you will smell ocean and sand and sunscreen and maybe like a little bit of hot dog. It's the smell of being at the beach. And the other smell is one of my favorite smells. It's called To See a Flower. and it's the smell of a flower in a garden. Yes. You smell a flower, but also earth and heat and water. It's the smell of being outside around flowers. And he has many, many crazy, fascinating smells. And if you end up with my smells at the end, please give them back to me because I want my smells back. The thing that is great about the sense of smell is that it is a pleasure for which we pay no price. Because you can eat a chocolate chip cookie, but you got to count the calories. And you can go to a museum, but you need to buy a ticket. And you could go here and check out as many books as you want, but you have to have the time and the mental focus to sit down and read them. But a smell is just a quick hit. You just walk through the kitchen and you pick up a grapefruit, or you unscrew the cap of a bottle of vanilla. Or you walk into a hardware store and you think, why is it that wherever you go, anywhere in the country, hardware stores have that hardware store smell? And you just enjoy it, let it give you a lift, and then you can move on. The next area I would suggest thinking about for happiness is possessions. Not because I think the possessions are the most important aspect to happiness, because I don't think they are, but there does seem to be something about possessions where they can weigh us down and get in our way. And one of the things that I wanted to do with my Happier at Home project was to figure out how to get more happiness out of my possessions and less of a feeling of being overwhelmed and paralyzed. And one of the resolutions, and as I thought about the relationship of possessions to happiness, I've been struck by two things. The first is that possessions, for most people, do have an important role to play in a happy life. And that is surprisingly controversial to say, because there's a strong impulse in people to say, simplicity, less is more, get rid of all your stuff, throw it all away, that's the way to happiness. But I think for most people, possessions are important. They allow us to project our identity into our environment, and they serve as important reminders of the people and places and activities that we love. And one of the resolutions that I followed to try to engage more deeply with my possessions was the resolution to cultivate shrines. And by a shrine, I mean a place of super engagement. For me, I have 12 personal commandments, and my most important personal commandment is to be Gretchen. And you should substitute your own name for that. One of the things that's true about Gretchen is I have this crazy passion for children's literature and young adult literature. I mean, I read it as a child, and I read it now as an adult all the time. And as Caitlin knows, I'm in three children's literature reading groups. But I realized that in my apartment, like, some of the books were here, some of the books were there, some were in some daughter's room, some were just, like, sitting in a pile in a corner somewhere because I didn't know what else to do with them. I can smell to see a flower right now. Yummy. So I went, cleared off a big bookshelf, gathered all my children's literature from all over the house, alphabetized it, included in it with it some mementos of children's literature, including my giant stack of Cricket magazines. Anybody else have these? Yes, I have every single one that I ever got. I've read them countless times. And just seeing them on the shelf, I don't even need to read them. Just seeing them makes me so happy. And the thing about my shrine is that it's not that I own anything that I didn't own before, but that by mindfully arranging it into this shrine, I make it so much more exciting. And I realize a lot of people have shrines sort of unconsciously. So I've seen shrines to tools, shrines to music, shrines to wine, shrines to Vermont. Anytime you have that area in your home that can bring you into that frame of mind, it's so exciting. And the other thing that has really struck me about the relationship of possessions to happiness is the degree to which, for most people, outer order contributes to inner calm more really than it should. Because, let's face it, in the context of a happy life, something like a messy coat closet or an overflowing inbox is trivial. And clearly it is trivial. And yet, over and over, people tell me, and I certainly feel this way myself, that there is something about getting control over the stuff of your life that makes you feel more in control of your life generally. And if that's an illusion, it's a helpful illusion. And as Caitlin mentioned, one of the most often mentioned resolutions that people will say to me, when I say, what resolutions have you tried? What's worked for you? The number one resolution that people say is the resolution to make your bed. How many people here regularly make their bed? How many people here make their bed in a hotel room on the morning they check out? All right, we will talk. Yes, that is the road. Yeah, that is the way. There's just something about getting control that makes you feel better. And so I was going through my apartment looking for, you know, trying to clear clutter. And my test is, do we need it? Do we use it? Do we love it? And if we don't, let's get rid of it. I identified a curious category of possessions that I had not quite noticed before. And I thought this was my private pathology, but I've talked to a lot of people. It turns out it's more widespread than I thought. I would describe this as things related to stalled projects. And so this is the resolution to abandon a project. So I found that there were these things where either I or my husband or my daughters had started some kind of project, and either it turned out not to be very fun, or it was too hard, or it required too many moving parts that we couldn't be bothered to gather together. And so it wasn't moving towards culmination. It had just sort of stalled out in some place. And in particular, we had a lot of origami sets. I looked around the apartment. We had like 9 sets of origami, some of which we got as gifts, but I'm sure I bought some of these because I had this fantasy of how lovely it would be for my daughters and me to sit around the table and make paper cranes or whatever, and how lovely. But actually, origami makes me crazy. It's way too frustrating and hard, and my daughters don't like it either. So we had all this origami. So I went around, gathered them up, and took them to my daughter's school. They were thrilled to have all the beautiful paper. And I've talked to people who have had, you know, learning to cook Chinese food, knitting a sweater, learning to make beer in your bathtub. If you abandon a project, you let yourself get this stuff off your shelves and off your conscience. But possessions, body, you know, what is the key to happiness if you're really going to push? Now, I think there's different answers to that question depending on what framework you use to talk about happiness, but ancient philosophers and contemporary scientists would agree that one answer, and maybe the best answer, is strong relationships with other people. To be happy, we have to have enduring, intimate relationships. We need to be able to confide. We need to feel like we belong. We need to be able to get support. And just as important for happiness, we need to be able to give support. So anytime we're thinking about how to spend our precious time, energy, or money, something that deepens relationships or expands relationships is something that's likely to make us happier. So in the context of a happier home, of course, I was thinking about my relationships centered on my home. And for me, that meant my husband and children, though everybody's different, so this would be different people would have different relationships that they were thinking about in relationship to their home. And Tolstoy memorably said that happy families are all alike. Now, that is debatable, but thought-provoking. And I thought, well, what do I think that happy families do? How are they alike? It struck me that one thing that they tend to do was to have fun traditions and delightful rituals that they follow. So I wanted to do that, but I also wanted to be realistic because the fact is I don't like shopping, I don't have any free time, I hate running errands, and my knees are already buckling under the combined weight of the Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas season, and my daughter's birthday party planning. So, you know, if I was going to do anything more, it had to be extremely manageable. So I hit on a resolution, by stealing the idea from a friend, to celebrate holiday breakfasts. So in our house, our apartment, for minor holidays like St. Patrick's Day, Leap Day, the last day of school, we have a holiday breakfast, and we just had one for Valentine's Day. A few placemats, a centerpiece, some candy, because my children are still young enough to think it's super exciting to have candy at breakfast, and the secret, my secret weapon of a holiday breakfast, which is food dye. Major production value with food dye. For Valentine's Day, I dye the milk pink. For St. Patrick's Day, you dye the scrambled eggs green. The crowd goes wild. And it's fun. It's fun because we're all together. It's very festive. It lasts 10 minutes. It doesn't take me any time or energy to set it up. I take a picture. It's great. And then it's done. And so it's really, really manageable. The last resolution that I'm going to propose, and then we're going to have questions. Again, that's my favorite part. The last resolution I want to propose is an exception. It's not like most of the other resolutions. It turns out that one of the sad facts about a happiness project is that the only person you can change is yourself. And this is frustrating because it's very tempting to think, I would be happier if other people would behave properly and to have a long list of resolutions for others to follow. But you can't do that. You only get to make resolutions for yourself. But what I found is that when I changed, my relationships changed. And when I changed, the atmosphere of my home changed. So it was possible to make larger changes by just working on myself. However, that is a very true rule, but there is one exception. And it's this resolution. I had noticed that my family had gotten into a very bad habit, which was that every time someone came or left the apartment, everyone just sort of grunted out a hello and didn't really look up from their book or their iPad or their homework or their, you know, newspaper or whatever. And I really did not like this. It did not have the attentive, tender level of engagement that I wanted. And so I sat everybody down at breakfast one day, and not a holiday breakfast, a regular breakfast, and said, you know, I don't like this. I feel like we're not paying enough attention to each other as we come and go. What do you think if we just tried to make a family agreement that we would all give warm greetings and farewells to make everybody feel like they're getting attention when they come and go? And somewhat to my surprise, everybody knew exactly what I was talking about and agreed to give warm greetings and farewells. And really, without any nagging or prompting, everyone has started doing this. It's something that's it's a very easy habit to pick up. And we call it warm greetings and farewells, even though that's sort of a prim way of saying it. I mean, my younger daughter, I forget things, you know, in a second. So I raced off the elevator through the apartment to write something down before I forgot it. And she comes stomping over to me and says, "You didn't even give me a warm greeting." But what I found, you know, and even my 14-year-old will sort of hang out by the elevator waiting for everybody to make a big fuss over her before she leaves. You know, I'm late, but she stands there and waits. And so it's one of these things where it doesn't take any time, energy, or money, and yet it can make this really profound change in the atmosphere of home. So the last thing I would say before we have questions is, now having done two happiness projects myself, I really do think that just about anyone can benefit from doing some kind of thing like this. Because to take the time to think about your own nature, your own values, and your own interests, and to figure out how to bring those values into your everyday life is something that can make you happier. So thank you. So any questions? Yes. Yes. I am working on a new book, but it's not about that per se. And every book that I write, I think this is the most fascinating subject in the whole world. the rest of my life is going to be downhill, because never again will I ever have a subject as interesting as the subject that I'm working on now. And I truly have thought that with every single book. And I have to say, this book is the most fascinating book of all time. And I can't believe, I just am obsessed with it. And this is a book about habits. Because what I realize is that habits are really the precursor to a happy life. And they are like the invisible architecture of happiness. And that if you have habits that incline you to happiness, you are going to be in a much better shape than if you have habits that are going to drag you down. So it's all about how do you think about shaping your habits. But it's interesting with a teenager, because you realize I'm very aware of what are the habits that I could help instill in her that would be helpful to her and to us as well. Making your bed. Now I have to confess, I make their beds, because it's just because I have to have the beds made, and it's easier to do it myself. But I'm going to work on that, and they're going to make their own beds. So I'm only indirectly thinking about teenagers. Well, let me, because I'm doing this, I'm going to use you guys as a test audience real quick. I'm going to describe four categories of people, and raise your, and then I'll go through it again and raise your hand if you fit into these categories. And this is important for habits and happiness. And this relates to how you respond to the idea of rules, an external rule or an internal rule. So an external rule is like the speed limit and a work deadline, and an internal rule is something like a New Year's resolution or a project that you're working on for yourself. So the first category of person is an upholder. An upholder readily accepts outer rules and inner rules. I am an upholder, 100%. Questioners question all rules, but they will follow a rule if they think it makes sense. But of course, rules that they generate for themselves have special validity. Rebels resist all rules. Tell them to do something, and they will do the opposite, even to themselves. They cannot give themselves rules very easily at all. And obligers accept outer rules but have trouble with inner rules. So like a friend of mine who's an obliger said, well, when I was on the track team, I never missed a practice, but I can't go running on my own. Okay, so I'm going to go through the categories. Raise your hand if you identify with one of these categories. Upholder, outer rules and inner rules. Oh, a lot of upholders. Good. Okay. Yeah. Team upholder. There's pros and cons to all of them. Everybody's like, people, whenever I mention it, they try to defend like why what they are is best, but all have pros and cons. Okay. Questioner. Yes. Okay. And questioners come with rebel flavoring or upholder flavoring. Rebels. All right. A couple. There we go. And obligers. It's interesting, obligers, it took me a long time to understand that category, and it's one of the biggest categories. Did anybody not find themselves in the four categories? Did they feel like nothing applied to them? Oh, that's good. Because every time you try to generalize about human nature, you want everybody to fit more or less. So, okay, that's good. That's very helpful. Okay, any more questions about happiness or about my, yes? That is a huge source of academic interest, which is cross-cultural examinations of happiness, definitions of happiness, and measuring happiness. And there's actually an initiative at the UN right now to try to come up with a global index, which, think about it. Start thinking about how you would do that, and you realize how challenging it is to come up with a global index of happiness. This is not something that interests me particularly, because I'm very focused on the individual, and in particular me. So I'm not that interested in, I didn't spend that much time looking at it other than to just realize it was there. It's interesting, I mean, clearly, you know, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, so it does feel uniquely American. But one thing is, a lot of times people will say to me things like, well, you know, us Americans, all we do is sit around and worry about whether we're happy or not. And I think, well, the fact is, on any kind of broad understanding of prosperity and security, we live in an extraordinarily prosperous and safe time. So it seems appropriate to me that people would turn their attention to higher things, like having satisfying work or wanting to have loving relationships with the people around them. That to me seems like a very appropriate response. So I don't really understand people who seem to think that kind of focus is not helpful, but I don't know what's going on in other countries. I know the UK, strangely, like last country you would think would be focused on this, they have a whole government initiative on it too. So it is a major focus of attention. Yes. Yes.
So many movies we go to, people each other.
Yeah. That comes from something called the negativity bias, or it's often summarized as bad is stronger than good. People, and this is just a psychological phenomenon of human nature, people are more attracted to bad news than good news, to criticism than compliments, to tragedy. That just catches our attention more, we remember it better, and we're more curious about it. And so definitely you see that reflected in the media. One thing that has really struck me as I've been researching happiness is there does seem to be a category of person who is deeply attracted to certain kinds of bad news. And I would call this potato chip news, because it doesn't have a lot of news value in that there's like content to it. It's like things like political commentary, like very virulent political commentary, true crime, natural disaster reporting. You know, you're like, how many hours can I watch the crane on 57th Street? You know, like hours people are watching the crane. Is it going to come down? I don't know. It's still up there. What are they going to do? There it is. You know. And they're very distressed about it. And I noticed this because I was going to interview Anne Lamott. I interviewed Anne Lamott at Symphony Space, so I was going onto her Facebook page just to sort of see what was happening there. And somebody said, you know, because if you don't know, Anne Lamott is very political. And she was very worked up about the election. And clearly she's a person who consumes a lot of potato chip political news. And somebody said, yes, I'm so worried about the election that I ate an entire pan of peanut butter brownies. And I thought, she's worried. This woman is worried about the election, and is binging on brownies. Like, that's not a helpful response, and it's not a, you know, and for people who get intensely worked up, and yet sort of can't look away, I think they really need to master their attraction to this, because, you know, everybody needs to know some negative news to be a good citizen. We need to be informed about what's happening in the world. But there comes a point where it's just like layers and layers of reading about suffering. And unless it's motivating you to action or informing you, it may just be upsetting you in a way that's counterproductive, in fact. It's making you less likely to be able to intervene than more able or less in command of yourself. So that's just one aspect of people who are very drawn to it. But it's absolutely true that there's a heavy weighting of reporting to the negative. Yes. 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 Okay. So an important point that's worth pointing out is there's happiness, unhappiness, and depression. And I would really always say that depression is a third category outside the realm of normal happiness and unhappiness. And certainly, yes. And depression is a very grave, urgent situation that every possible remedy should be thrown at that. So I would never say that what I'm writing about is meant for people who suffer from depression. Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of times when they want you to, I don't know if you've seen these things where you're supposed to, measure your mood at any particular time. To me, that drives me crazy. Like, if you're like, how happy are you right now? I just feel like that makes me, I can't even say. So I think most people are kind of going back between happiness and unhappiness, or it's more about, again, moving in the right direction, generally becoming happier, rather than trying to figure out, or like saying, am I at the top of my natural range? Like, have I felt happier at other times of my life, or do I feel like? A great example of this was a friend of mine who had a job that he absolutely hated. So he's the same person, he has the same genetic makeup, the same life circumstances more or less, but he went from a job that he hated to a job that he loved, and clearly it had a very massive effect on his happiness. And I remember him saying to me, we were living in D.C., he said, I was on the subway, and I was feeling this, like, horrible feeling in the pit of my stomach. And then I thought, wait a minute, I'm not at the job anymore. And, you know, he had this transformative effect. So, you know, I think that we always should be thinking about, can we be happier? But I think on a day-to-day, at least for me, it's not that helpful to be trying to measure it too specifically, because it can just sort of make you crazy. Yeah. You're right. No, I love coming here, and this is one of the reasons that I've always been attracted to libraries my whole life. And one of the things I like is that, I don't know if any of you have been up there, but it's like you do not say a word. And there are people that I've been working next to for like 10 years, and I have never spoken to them because, like, you do not talk. And yet there is this sense of, you know, of industry and common purpose, and everybody's sort of there together. And it's very energizing and reassuring to be with people. And then I do have some friends that I know, and we sneak off into the staircase and talk. But I wish that I could have a more structured day, because for me, every day is different. I do work from 6 to 7 a.m. every day, and I try to have at least 3 hours of original writing, which is my highest and most difficult kind of writing every day, and I have to figure out when it comes. And then I also have to write for my blog, and that's like a lesser kind of writing. Then there's note-taking, which is a lesser form of writing. So every day I'm kind of trying to figure out if I can get all those things in. It has a lot of, and like thinking about habits, it has a lot. I've been thinking about what are my habits, and could they be better, what's working, what's not working. Yes. 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 This is one of the constant tensions within happiness, which is like, how do you measure the present and the future? Because some people are like, oh, just think about the present, but that doesn't work. You can't do that. But then if you think too much about the future, then that never leads to happiness either. So I think this is a constant tension. Sometimes it is helpful to think, like, in 6 months or in 5 years, what will I wish I did? That sometimes makes it clearer. And then sometimes, I mean, one of the things that I can do as a non-scientist is I can say things like, happiness doesn't always make you feel happy. Which a scientist could not say, but I can say. And sometimes we do things, one of the things that makes us happy is to live a life that reflects our values. And sometimes living a life that reflects our values actually makes us feel unhappy. And I always think of an example that somebody gave me where he said he had a horrible, mean father and who was in the hospital dying. And he was an adult, and he had two adult brothers, and they had a difficult enough relationship with their father that two of the sons refused to visit the father. Only the one son would go to the hospital. And he said, the thing is, it doesn't make me happy. It makes me miserable. I have a terrible relationship with him. He's a big jerk. It's really depressing to go to the hospital. You know, should I just do what makes me happy and not go? And yet I feel like I should go. And to me, I would say, well, to live a life that reflects your values, sometimes you do things that don't make you feel happy. And to your sense of what your obligation as a son to your father is, even though this is a very difficult situation, this is what you feel like you should do. And so living a life that reflects your values is something that makes you happy. So with something like a dinner party, you're like, there's a lot of parts about it that aren't going to make me happy, and there's probably many points where I'll wish that I hadn't done it. But in the end, this is the kind of life that I want, and this is what I want to expect for myself. So, I mean, another way to think about this is this tension that to be happy, you have to accept yourself and expect more from yourself. And where does that line fall is something that you have to be thinking about every day. So do you accept yourself and say, I'm the kind of person who doesn't like to have dinner parties? Or do you expect more from yourself and say, I'm the kind of person who can have dinner parties? Or you do what I do, which is order Chinese food and let everybody eat off of paper plates. And I'm like, it's this or nothing, guys. And they're like, okay. You know, so lower the bar. That's lower the bar, which is make it easy enough to do it. But it is a tension within happiness for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, he's a friend of mine. Yeah. Oh, great. Well, you know what? He didn't cover it at all. He talked about the power of habits. And you would come away from his book thinking, wow, habits are powerful. Target knows my habits. Saddleback Creek is using my habits. Habits affected the civil rights movement. But how does that help you finish your PhD thesis? How does that help you exercise? How does that help you go to bed on time? How does that help you have leisure? To me, it was like an argument for why they were important, but not, and actually there's very little, there's bits and pieces everywhere, but there's very little that just sort of says to you, how do you think about yourself and your own nature and what you're trying to accomplish and how you might set up habits in a different way in order to increase the likelihood that you can stick to it? For something like exercise, which is definitely probably one of the top three habits that people want to acquire, there's a lot of different ways that you can think about instilling that habit in yourself. So how would you sort of go through all your options so that you have the highest chance of one sticking? So I loved his book. He's a terrific guy, and he did an amazing job as a reporter explaining why they're so significant. And I feel like that's what everybody wants to know. Yeah. He talked about not eating a chocolate chip cookie at 3 o'clock. And he analyzed sort of the part of that. But yeah, he was really much more interested in talking about how habits, like how Target can target your habits and how it can understand what's happening in your life by looking at your habits. So it's fascinating about how a lot of it was about how institutions use habits, Starbucks, how they think about habits, but it is not on the individual. It wasn't really looking at it from an individual standpoint. Yeah. So, but he knows. I told him that I was writing this book because for me, I wrote a book about Churchill, and now still to this day, if somebody else writes a book about Churchill, I feel very annoyed because I'm like, you know, we're done. We're done with this. Like, dang, yeah, it's my turf. You know, which clearly is irrational. So I was saying to Charles, like, I don't know if you're as crazy as I am, but I have to let you know I'm writing a book about habits, but it's going to be very different. And he was like, that's cool. So anyway, and his book is terrific. I highly recommend it. It's called The Power of Habits, and it is about the power of habits. Do you think that's true? Do you think that's true that she was happy? No. Well, that's a very. I mean, what's the helpful thing to do is to say, well, why was I happier in the past? You know, what was it about the past? Was it that I was in a place where I had tons of friends, or was it that I had a big, beautiful garden that I was working in, or was my health better, or? And then to think, well, if something, is there something that I can bring into the present? One of the saddest facts, I think, from the research on happiness is that one of the best indicators of whether someone is going to be happy in the present is whether they've been happy in the past, which is kind of like telling somebody that the way to be thin is never to gain weight. But it has a lot of implications, because if you're with somebody, if you meet somebody like you're interviewing for a job with a boss who seems very unhappy, it is not likely, if you look at the, you know, what usually happens, that that person will change. Because usually people who are happy in the past are happy in the present, and people who aren't unhappy in the past tend to be unhappy in the present. Now, of course, that can change, and there's like my friend who got the new job and it had a dramatic impact. But it's certainly something worth thinking about. So one of it is like, well, is it true? And then another thing is, well, then what could you bring forward? Because, one thing that's very helpful is to think, what is actually happening now that might be creating unhappiness? And just by identifying it, sometimes you see an easy way to fix it. Somebody just posted on my blog how she'd moved to this community and she'd lived there for 2 years and she didn't really know anybody, and And then she got a dog. And so she went out and walked her dog 3 times a day. So she lost 20 pounds. She met all her neighbors. People were inviting her over. They had like a little puppy play group. You know, it was just this one tiny little change had led to a quite dramatic difference. And so, but it's hard. It's hard. And some people are just naturally yours too. And that's tough. Oh my gosh. I mean, they're all like, no, because they're all horrible. They're like, subjective well-being is the ongoing heuristic, you know, blah, 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 blah. No, none of them strike. No, and I'm sure, you know, the Willa Cather, what is the Willa Cather? Happiness is to be bound up in something. I quoted this today, and now I can't remember it. To be truly great. Wait, is to be, yeah, okay, Mark's going to look it up on his phone. She had a great, Willa Cather has a great definition of happiness. Okay. We'll come back to that because it's a great quotation. I pride myself on my ability to bring up a lot of quotations, but this one I don't have by heart. Yeah.
So one of the things you said is one of the ways to be happy is, you know, to have deep and meaningful relationships.
Yes.
Ooh. That has depth and can continue on for
that is a big question. I haven't done enough thinking about that. I think that's a really big, important question. Because when I started this, I was sort of already set in that, so it was more about like living up to what I already had more than identifying it. And I feel like I'm not sure that my experience would be that useful because I am one of these people who totally had love at first sight. I was like, who's that guy? And, you know, and then like, you know, 11 months later we were engaged kind of thing. And I only had one relationship before that. So in my own experience, I haven't done a lot of reading about it. But that's clearly an incredibly important decision and to think about. So I wouldn't want to opine. Yes. Oh, for habits. I thought you were going to say for happiness. Oh, well, one interesting thing about happiness is that older people tend to be happier, which comes as a surprise to a lot of people. And the thinking of why this is so is that older people know themselves better and accept themselves, and also they have a sense of priority. So they don't spend time on people they don't like. They don't do things that aren't important to them. And so because of the negativity bias, they seem to be more positive, like they notice positive more than negative. And so that's very interesting. Now, the thing about habits, and now I'm going to go a little bit into my habit mode. One thing that's very interesting about habits that I want to talk about that I feel like hasn't been enough emphasized is starting. Starting is a very key time for a habit. So anytime you are starting, you're starting a new job, you're having a new baby, you're moving to a new town, you're graduating from college, your children are leaving home, you're retiring, anytime, you know, you've got an illness or you're recovering from an illness, anytime you are starting, you have an opportunity to set your habits afresh. And so you want to make the most of any kind of start time. And clearly people know this instinctively. That's why we have New Year's resolutions, because that's sort of an arbitrary but commonly accepted start. The beginning of the school year is a new year, your birthday, milestone moments. All these things are kind of moments when people have a feeling of a start. And that's just really something that you can take advantage of. One place where it's often mentioned is that when people move is often a very good time for them to quit smoking because they have a whole new set. Okay, let's see. Okay, here's a good one. That is happiness, to be dissolved into something complete and great. That's Willa Cather, who, Mark tells me, checked out books from Society Library. How cool is that? So everything that rises must converge. Everything comes together at Society Library. Okay, don't let me forget to give this to you. One more question. Yes. My notoriety. It's made me happy. I mean, the thing is, for any writer, you want to feel like you strike a chord with readers. And so it's tremendously exciting and gratifying to me that my books have found an audience, because I have written books that, like, we shall just say, did not find their audience. And I loved writing them, and I wouldn't trade that because it was so much fun to write them myself. But it's nice when you feel like a lot of people are reading it. And then, of course, I have this other whole blog writing existence, which for a writer is like a whole new identity for me, because I've been writing books for years and had written several books, but this is a whole new thing, and it's a whole new set of skills and it's a whole new vibe, it's a whole new group of people. It's fun to be part of it. And so, and it's fun, you know, to write something and hear people respond to, like, when I wrote about the four types of people, like, people started responding to me, and so instantly I could feel that my understanding of the subject was getting deeper, because I was hearing from all these people, a far greater range of people than I could ever come into contact in my everyday life. And so to be able to engage with an audience like that is gratifying and also very helpful from a research standpoint, because I can throw out an idea. For instance, one thing that I write about is my personal commandment to spend out, which I thought I was the only person who had this. Truly, I thought I was deeply idiosyncratic. Turns out many, many people have this. So spend out is, people who have trouble spending out are people who have kind of hoarding natures. So, like, they don't want to put things to use or use things up. So they'll do things like not use perfume. They'll save it. They'll save stationery. Like, I would buy new white T-shirts but then not wear them because I wanted to keep them nice. And so I would keep wearing my old nasty T-shirts. Or the most poignant example someone told me was, she said, when my mother died, we went to clean out of her house. And I found a set of fancy china that I had never seen in my whole life. Never did a day come that was special enough for my mother to use her good china. And now I use the china every day. So, and if you are this kind of person, it's like, use the stationery, use the perfume, use the bath salts, use the umbrella with the silver handle, you know. Don't save it. And I have this idea, even intellectually. Like, today I wrote something and I had to say to myself, I felt like I should save it. I'm like, I'm saving this for my next book. I'm like, no. Spend out. Use it up. Put it out there. There always will be more. But this is something where, because I can engage, I can learn so much more. And then hopefully then that just makes the books all the better. So thank you so much. This is so much fun. Thank you, Society Library.